Okay.
Okay.
The next speaker then is Eileen. So
yeah. Okay. There are handouts coming around. I'm sorry I was too inefficient to put them at the back. If you haven't got a handout, put your hand up and then hopefully those passing them around will get them to you. Right. I'm out of my normal comfort zone in this. So. Okay. So I've called this talk Thought, Language and Perception. And the basic theme is that if thought requires language, then animals and children can't think. But if perceptual experience counts as thought, then perhaps they can. So first some background. Now I think you'll find this quite familiar because of the very helpful stuff that Christian was saying just now. So thought and language are inextricably linked. I think we discovered this just now. But there's a divide between philosophers as to how they're related. Now, one side holds that it's only via the acquisition of language that creatures can think at all. But the other side holds that thought precedes language, or that language presupposes thought. Now, Michael Dummett sums up these two points of view on the quotes on your handout. Okay, and there's also a list of the people that hold whichever view. Now, the language first school are people like Dummett himself, who's an anti-realist, and John McDowell, whom I'll be discussing shortly. Now, McDowell is not a philosopher of language, but a philosopher of thought. However, he shares Dummett's view that thought only develops along with language. Now, the thought first school includes an awful lot of philosophers of language, because most philosophers of language tend to be realists. And they think, particularly if they're interested in theory of reference, because they're interested in exploring how we use language to refer to and express our thoughts about an external world which they take for granted and which they think is knowable. Now, my sympathies are with the philosophers of thought, but there is a big problem with their account of thought, which we come to now. This is section two. Okay. Now, in a nutshell, thoughts and the concepts of which they are composed, that Christian told you about just now, require such a high level of cognitive and reasoning skills that only language-possessing creatures are capable of having them. Now, a lot of us are going to be worried by this, particularly if we've had kids. So let's look at the traditional philosophical conception of thought and concept and see why this is. Now, it's generally agreed that thoughts are structured. They have components, and these components are called concepts. You've got to call the components something. Concepts is quite a good word for them. Now, on the Phrygian model, Frege, the father of logic, the thought of a complete atomic sentence, like John is happy, is its sense or meaning, or what we usually call the proposition expressed by it. Again, this echoes what Christian said. Now, the sentence has just two components, the subject John, the predicate is happy, and it's only when we put the two together that we get a complete thought. And the same thought or proposition could be expressed by Jean Coutan or Hansis Glücklich. Okay. Now, for Frege, a concept is a technical term. So it's the reference of a predicate. So a concept for Frege can be of an object. If we have a noun in predicate position, as in at the table, or the concept may be of a property if we have an adjective in a predicate position. So this table is brown or rectangular. Now, Frege's view has the advantage that the senses of concepts are abstract public entities. They're not internal or private ones. Now, some people do hold that concepts are private, and I think Jerry Fogler is one of them. But whether they're internalists or externalists, concepts still feature as the components of thoughts. Now I'm coming to Gareth Evans. Gareth Evans died tragically young at age 34 in 1980, and he wrote a book which has become seminal in the philosophy of language, and it's called The Varieties of Reference. Now, he's really a philosopher of thought, but he's very deep, much more deep than many philosophers of language. Now, he follows the Phrygian line with regard to the structure and public nature of language. But for him, having a thought doesn't necessarily involve the apprehending and manipulation of symbols, at least on the conscious level. Thoughts are structured because they are complex of distinct conceptual abilities. Now, concept possession requires the capacity to form thoughts, both recognitional, when you recognize an object, and inferential, to do with objects and properties. That's a simple example. So if someone who thinks that John is happy and Harry is happy exercises on two occasions the conceptual ability, which we call possessing the concept of happiness. And similarly, someone who thinks that John is happy and that John is sad exercises on two occasions a single ability, the ability to think about John. Okay. Now, Evans calls this the generality constraint. This is because one can generalize a concept from a known context to an unknown one in the absence of the object or entity that the concept is of. So I can talk about Marianne on the phone to someone, as I did a couple of weeks ago, and discuss whether she might be approached to give a talk. Okay. Now, Evans, like Bertrand Russell before him, is interested in singular thought. That is, the conditions under which one can single out an object in thought prior to applying a linguistic term to it and prior to making a judgment or an inference about it. This is why he's interested in more fundamental issues than Frege. So, if one has the capacity to single out a particular object in thought, to Evans, one has the concept of that particular object. Now, for Russell, the capacity to single out an object in thought requires being able to distinguish that object from all other objects. Now, Evans calls this Russell's principle. As Evans interprets Russell's principle, it doesn't mean that you need to know everything about an object that there is to know before you can talk about it. That would be absurd. But he doesn't become the skeptic that Russell became, because he was worried by this. But it does mean that if you abide by Russell's principle, you need sufficient discriminatory knowledge to say that you're thinking about, say, Jonathan and not Jean. Now, if we accept Russell's principle and the generality constraint, which means moving concepts around contexts and playing around with them to form complete thoughts, propositions, that requires a high level of cognitive skill and the use of language, and it's because of this that it precludes animals and infants from possessing concepts and hence from being able to think. So we get an argument which looks like something like the one on your sheet. I hope this works. Thoughts are structured, the components of thoughts are concepts. Concepts are subject to the generality constraint, which requires language. Therefore, concepts require language. Therefore, thought requires language. Animals and infants have no language, therefore they have no concepts, therefore they can't think. Now, I think that most of us would want to resist this view. Pre-linguistic infants and clever animals clearly seem capable of thought. Infants from a young age have expectations about the behaviour of moving objects. Expressing surprise, for example, if one solid object appears to pass through another. And we're all familiar with the well-documented problem-solving capabilities of apes and crows. So, what's to be done? Now, I don't want to reject those first four premises of the argument because it would mean rejecting the generality constraint. And the kinds of rational discourse that human beings engage in some of the time, may not be very often, but they do engage in it some of the time, requires it. Otherwise your notion of a concept just has no teeth and does no work. Now what we need to explain now is how the higher level conceptual thinking of the kind that philosophers indulge in and which does require language develops from the more primitive kinds of non-linguistic thinking that we want to attribute to animals and infants. Okay, now this is where thought and perception come in. It's sort of mutants. Now, those who deny thought to animals and pre-linguistic infants, it's McDowell who I'm coming to in a minute, readily accept that they perceive their environment. So, the next question is whether all perceptual experience has to be conceptual, or whether there's some perception which is non-conceptual but still has content or significance for the perceiver. Does this make sense?
Yep.
Okay. As long as that significance is not provided by concept or language, now this would allow us to attribute thought to animals, for instance, okay, by perception. Now again, philosophers, of course, are sharply divided. The anti-conceptualists, now they include Gareth Evans, who I've just been talking about, and Christopher Peacock, who wrote a book called, Concepts? The Study of Concepts in 1980. Very difficult book. I've tried to read it three times and failed. Okay. So they argue that not all perceptual experience is conceptual. Human adults share some perceptual content with infants and animals that's non-conceptual, but of significance. It's not just kind of stimulus response perception, okay, proper perception. Because only in this way can we leave room for an account of how thought evolved and how children learn to think. Okay, now Evans, for example, he talks about an information system shared with animals, which is more primitive, does not satisfy the generality constraint, but provides a bridge towards fully-fledged singular thought. Now, José Luis Bermúdez, who combines philosophy and cognitive science, very good book called Thinking Without Words, thoroughly recommend it. He points out a distinction, which some of you must have thought of, between two kinds of thought, thinking how and thinking that. Now, thinking how is generally perceptual, often visual, and involves practical problem solving of the kind that a toddler does when she tries to fit bits of a toy together, or the kind that a chimpanzee engages in when it tries to work out how to get at a bunch of bananas which is out of reach. Okay. Now, thinking that, on the other hand, is propositional thinking, conceptual thinking, requires language. Now, language users like ourselves use both sorts of thinking all the time. Now, the conceptualist camp resists views like this, insisting that all thought, genuine thought, has to be of the higher level conceptual kind which requires language, even though it means that we can't attribute thought to babies and animals. Now, as I have been hinting at, the key player here is John McDowell, who in 1994 wrote a book called Mind and World. Now, we need to get an idea of what's wrong with this very influential account before we can consider the possibility of non-linguistic thought. McDowell is a neo-Kantian, and he wants to see, as I understand it, a seamless fit between mind, thought, and world, all of the things. Now, his conceptualism, the view that there is no non-conceptual thought, arises from attempt to solve what he sees as a fundamental flaw in empiricism. Now, empiricism is a view that I'm sure you're familiar with, stemming from Locke and Hume, that our knowledge of the external world is acquired by the senses. Now, empirical knowledge, classically, is seen as having two distinct components. This is on your sheet. A given raw data, uninterpreted, and this can be phenomenal, like qualia, and this provides the content to our basic beliefs about how the world is. And the other component is the interpretation or conceptual scheme. Now that is the analytic a priori truths of logic employed by the mind to process this raw data, and the given and the interpretation work together, allegedly, to produce empirical knowledge, which are inferential beliefs based on matters of fact. Okay, now for McDowell, the problem with this picture is that we end up with two allegedly distinct and incompatible areas of discourse. The first he calls the logical space of nature. This is where the natural sciences function. Descriptive empirical statements, like this table is brown, are in this category. The second category is what McDowell, following Wilfred Sellers, calls the logical space of reasons. This is the term that comes straight from Kant. So this is the frame. The logical space of reasons is the framework within which our conceptual thinking, our so-called world-directed beliefs, operates. Now the problem arises when one tries to make an inference from a statement in the logical space of nature, that's empirical statements, to a belief in the logical space of reasons. Sellers and McDowell with him think that one is committing a naturalistic fallacy. Now you've probably heard this expression from Hume, when he said that you can't move from an is to an ought. It's an illegitimate logical move from a factual statement to a normative one. Okay, now why do they think that there's a category mistake in saying you can't move from a statement about a world, a statement about the world, to a belief that the statement about the world is true? Now, according to Sellers and McDowell, knowledge is a normative concept. It has to conform with a norm. So a belief has to comply with the norms of truth and justification. But the empirical statement, this table is brown, is not normative. It can't ground a belief within the space of reasons that the table is brown. But this is what empiricism tries to do. Sense data or perceptual experiences, being in the space of nature, are deemed to ground our world directed beliefs. And according to McDowell, they can't do that. Now you don't disagree, but this is what you think. And this is his solution. Okay. What he does is he moves perceptual experience, the data, the sense data, from the logical space of nature into the logical space of reasons and integrates it completely there. And all perceptual experience becomes conceptual. So we haven't got a fallacy problem anymore. Thought and perceptual experience are mutually dependent. So we get the Kantian slogan, thoughts without content are empty. So thoughts require something, conceptual thoughts need something in the world to look onto, or they've got no content. But intuitions, that is perceptual experiences without concept, that's it, that's without shape of mind. So we're embedded in and perceive a world which impinges on us, not via raw data, which is the empiricist view, but has already conceptualized. Now this may seem like a very attractive move, until we see what McDowell actually means by conceptual. Now, a quote on your sheet. It's essential to conceptual capacities that they can be employed in active thinking, thinking that is open to reflection about its own rational credentials, that is, thoughts about thoughts. When I say that the content of experience is conceptual, this is what I mean by conceptual. Okay, so how do infants and animals fit into this picture? Well, mere animals, says McDowell, are limited to coping with the pressures of their environment. We may allow them a proto-subjective perceptual sensitivity to features of their environment, but this need not amount to an awareness of the outer world. Moreover, feelings of pain or fear need not amount to an awareness of an inner world. As for human infants, these are born mere animals, They are transformed into thinkers and intentional agents in the course of coming to maturity by being initiated into a language. Language enables an individual human being to emancipate herself from the merely animal mode of living and emerge into the freedom that rationality gives. Okay, now, I don't really like the consequences of McDowell's view. Therefore, I'm trying to find reasons to reject it. Okay, now it seems to me that their attack on the myth of the given, the myth of the raw data impinging on our consciousness, this is motivated by their commitment to the view that the natural and the rational occupy mutually exclusive spaces which are different in kind. And the logical space of reasons he regards as sui generis, it's something special and not open to question. Now, this implies that there's something non-natural about human rational thought, and it seems to me to make it a mystery how conceptual thought and language could have got off the ground in the first place. But I'm suggesting that if we see the domain of nature and the domain of rationality as occupying the same logical space, the alleged natural fallacy also disappears. Perceptual experience and rational thinking are both part of the domain of nature. Now, I know the table's there because I'm sitting on it, I can see it, I can scratch my name on it. The justification, or rather the truth maker of my belief that the table is there, is the table itself, the object. So while McDowell is right to see us as embedded in the world, it's the world itself, via our interaction with it, including our perceptual experiences of it, which shapes our thoughts about it. And our thoughts ultimately shape our language and our logic. Now, can I defend such a view? Oh, well, I've got about 2 minutes left, so hardly. But we'll just make a start, and then straight open to you. Okay. As noted above, Bermudez distinguishes between thinking how, which is perceptual and non-linguistic, practical thinking, from thinking that, which is propositional, conforms to the generality constraints and requires mastery of language. Now, this is a very good distinction. It's useful, but it seems inadequate. We need to bridge the gap. And to do that, we need an account of proto-conceptual thinking for non-language or pre-language users. Now, I think it can be done, but can only hint at how. And I'm sure you'll have ideas on this too. Now, recall Evans' claim that concept possession requires the capacity to form appropriate thoughts about objects or properties. And these thoughts about objects and properties are both recognitional and inferential. Now, most would accept that recognitional capacities in the presence of the object, usually an offspring or a parent, are widespread in the animal kingdom. So it's plausible to suppose that there's a spectrum of recognitional capacities from this very fundamental biological function to fully-fledged singular thought and the ability to make an identity judgment, for example. But most philosophers would hold that inference is a purely linguistic matter. After all, it's the key tool of philosophical argument. But I suggest that inference, too, is based on our perception of how the world works. So as my parting shot, I'm going to give you a couple of quotes. First, here's David Wiggins on how we acquire the concept of identity, not via language, but via engagement with the world. And this grounds our inferences concerning the identity and the counterfactual existence conditions, what might have been, of the individuals that we talk about. He says, we get these identities from our practical involvement in the singling out, the identification, the re-identification of the continuance that we refer to. We learn how objects of this or that particular kind look, how they come into being, go out of being, move, change, develop, interact with one another, interact with other kinds of things, and interact with creatures like us. And it's only by the workings of the capacities we derive from this involvement that we learn to think speculatively about the life histories of things not tracked continuously. And the final quote is from a cognitive psychologist. Upon seeing a member of a kind now, cup for example, and a member of a different kind, for example a dog, at a later time, we infer that there are two numerically distinct entities. But certain property changes signal a change in identity only within certain kinds of objects. For example, if you see a small chair in the corner now, and a big chair there later, you infer that there are two numerically distinct chairs. But if you see a small plant in the corner now and a larger one there a month or two later, it's not necessarily the case that there are two distinct plants. I rest my case. Yes, questions, yeah. I'll go back here.
You say researching for reasons to reject McDowell. If a human hasn't learned language by the age of 14, then they cannot, and there's a few unfortunate people in that category. Now, one could take these unfortunate guinea pigs and find out just what thinking they are able to do, and I suspect they can do almost every type of thinking, except they can't use language. Has that been considered?
That's all right, that's in my favour, thank you.
Yes.
I think I'm right, but by the time I realised what I wanted to write my talk about, it was too late. Okay, so that's a talk I would do on another occasion, thank you. I'm concerned by
you,
my
name,
yeah, so that's good.
Sorry,
are you...
General, I don't know, yes, it's something at one point, is to do with absence. It's conceiving of something, I mean, an object or whatever, in its absence. Now, that, see, you can get, I have a story. I have an 18-month-old granddaughter, and she's just learning to fit.
That's a good age for observing this kind of thing.
Yes, she's learning to fit objects into shapes on the board, and these happen to be letters.
Okay.
And recently she was trying to do this, and some of them were missing. Now she doesn't know the names of the letters, but when she came to the ones that were missing, she had a word for it not being there, which was, uh-oh. So she developed the word for absence. She learned her own expression. She knew the concept of absence.
Okay, so she's got a thought before she's got the language to cover it.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, well done. Thank you, Peter. That's the second point.
I agree with your argument, but I think you probably conceded more than you needed to earlier.
Oh, did I? All right, go on, tell me how.
Your paragraph was probably summarised. You said you had to accept the first four points. But number four was, therefore, concepts require language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're questioning my logic here, you may well.
It seems to me, along the lines of what people say, that animals have concepts. I mean, they recognize their kind of food, mm-hmm. They recognize the berries they eat, and so on. So they have to have concepts. And without language. So I think you can go very much more direct.
Basically you're challenging premise three, which is concept is subject to the generality concept. Actually that's the question. If you did have a concept of food or edibility.
It doesn't say a linguistic concept,
then?
No. Concept, you say one can generalize the concept from a known concept, so
basically the philosophers of thought, so who are linguists, that they tend to assume that it's all done via language. And if you're saying that the generality constraint could be applied to thought in the absence of language. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, it's a great. To me, that is straightforward.
Okay. Well, I should try and work that through.
Mike? I find it endlessly fascinating to see to what extent all disagreements within artificial intelligence in 1960s, 70s are replayed in philosophy. Because one of the issues at the time, and still is it, in fact, is how do they acquire concepts? How the machines, which are supposed to manipulate symbols, how do they acquire those symbols?
Well, they don't eat and drink and do all the other things.
Yeah, unfortunately, Irene, unfortunately, your story doesn't go far enough. You still have a gap, I believe. And the gap is in recognizing an object, just an object. What is a separate object in your perceptual field? And neither artificial intelligence people nor philosophers have solved this one, as far as I know.
No, but there's plenty of empirical evidence.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'm asking how, not whether.
But didn't some scientists, Durkheim actually, show this, draw this conclusion?
Oh, yeah, that is the case. Yes, and I'm saying how.
yeah, but I don't think that matters. I don't really care how.
It's merely an ethical issue.
There's subconscious mechanisms going on which make it the case that children do tend to pick out objects. They pick out objects before they pick out properties, I think, as has been shown.
We agree. And you are born with this. This is
the point.
Or as close to a neonate.
Okay. So it's really not a great surprise that language tends to have a subject-predicate structure, because it mirrors how we see the world. Now, of course, the world may not be...
That's what it is.
Sorry?
Yes, that's the concept of object. That.
You mean I can grab that?
Okay. There are people who can grab that.
I think you're... You were the next one, the other question?
Well, just an observation. I was quite impressed by my grandchild's nursery routinely teach sign language to preschool children.
Yes.
Perfectly able to sign. And another aside, many creatures have a very highly developed language. Can you have language without thought?
All those bird calls.
I really need to know a little bit more about that. Are you agreeing with me?
Okay.
I really need a secretary to take all these points down. I'll be ever so grateful if you've come up with a good idea. Please email me. I would appreciate
it. It's all on the recordings.
Oh, I can't listen to my point.
Anyway. I've been fascinated by philosophy of language, but that's because, you know, we talk and we argue and we create our operating propositions. But when I look at my grandchildren, they're all into visual arts and the television. The world has got much more visual since that time and less language.
And
I do wonder about the effect of that. If you think about a painter painting an abstract picture,
yeah,
he needn't have a concept of what he's going to do to get the picture quote right. He's going to try it and think about what he wants to do next on his canvas without conceptualizing, it seems to me.
Yeah, you're agreeing with me, aren't you?
I think thought is a very wide concept.
And doesn't have to be verbal. He doesn't have to have thinking. I'll put a bit of red just there.
But he might.
But he might.
So, the question is, do concepts have to be... Sorry, you've got on. There are more hands up.
You just need to raise a hand. I know you're down in the right order, and then... There's a long list now. We need to see where we cut. Okay.
Wait, is that it?
No, then we had you had a question, right?
It was an observation more. I don't know, I find it extremely difficult to think of language coming before concepts. It just doesn't, that's not something that makes sense to me in any way.
Language, thoughts being composed of concepts. No, it's a way of systematizing language and logic.
No, the idea quite... that language comes before concepts. That wasn't actually what I was going to say. I was going to say more weights in your favour. Just the example of the monkey trained to do a task and given grapes as a reward. And you can see this on YouTube. Two monkeys in cages next to each other. And they're both rewarded in the same way. Then the researcher changes and one of the monkeys gets a stone for doing the task. The other monkey gets a grape.
Right.
Again, the first monkey observes this. The second time it happens, looks at the stone in utter disgust. Looks back. You know, are you serious? And throws it at the researcher.
How about you?
there's no language there.
No.
Jim, do you have a question?
Yeah, relative to that concept, I would just like to mention again Google's
cache. Can you speak up a bit, please?
Sorry. Relative to that position of concepts,
yes.
I'd just like to mention again Google's cache. But if Google had built this relatively large neural network, and the network effectively invented the concept of a cat from looking at loads and loads of data. It's a function of neural networks.
Right, okay.
That's engineering, not
the voice. That's explaining how a brain picks concepts out and, picks out
Sorry?
I think particularly in Alan's question, I noticed, I think there is a distinction which has been missed between words and language. Because a child does not produce words, you know, it's not an efferent phenomenon, that doesn't mean it hasn't been exposed in an afferent phenomenon right from when it was in the womb. So a child in the womb is language influenced before it can ever produce.
Yeah.
And one of the lovely experiments that I reckon illustrates this point is if you give pencil and paper to, let's say, 10-month-old kids, usually before they are producing language, and you give pencil and paper also to young bonobos, both of them will scribble. And if you show the scribbles to adult humans, we can't discriminate. We don't know which one's the bonobo, which one's the child. And what is the point at which we start to say, I think this is the child, is precisely the point at which the child starts using language. As soon as the child starts using language, it starts to represent. It's on paper. It's not scribbles anymore. It's, you know, those wonderful hands which are circles.
Would you accept that thought precedes language?
Well, it depends on what you think thought is. And what I'm talking about tomorrow is very much related.
Okay. I think we take the last question, right?
Once or twice you use the phrase simply a thought.
Yes.
I wonder if you could elucidate the meaning of that.
It was the thing that Russell was obsessed with. I don't know whether you can pick a, because he had this view that to be able to have a thought about a particular object and to know that you were thinking about that object, you had to know everything there was to know about it. And this led him to a very kind of, it led him to be a sceptic about knowledge and what you could know about the world. But the idea of singular thought was taken over by Evans and others. I mean, it's a very useful idea. It's just thinking about a thing.
Do they mean the same as Russell?
Yeah, but they would mean the same by it, yes. And philosophers of language do mean that by singular thought. It's referring to a particular thing and the various means by which you do this. This is what Evans discusses. You don't necessarily have to have Russell's scepticism that is possible. I mean, Russell didn't think it was possible. Okay.
Okay, I think you asked a very last question.
The idea as well on the permanence of objects. A child throws, I think it's a child about 8 months when the recognition of the object happens. The child throws something out of the pram and it doesn't look to see where it is. I think it's about the age of eight months. It suddenly actually recognises the object that it associates his own action and the actual object. So doesn't that combine the world of how and the world of what? And I think his work goes on in this vein.
I think in the case of children, we can come up with lots of evidence and lots of arguments. I think there is a bigger problem with animals. Yeah. Because how could you ever show that an animal had was thinking about something that wasn't there? That seems to be the ethic.
What's a capture of an empty boat?
Yep.
Except that animals can get things right and wrong. Like a child, I've seen a child recently go like this to a book. A child of about 18 months pressed it because she happened to have an iPad or whatever those things were, but she couldn't work out.
Now, an animal can do it. Giving these things to
I know.
Before they learn how ordinary objects work,
an animal can be right or wrong, though, in the same way.
Yes. Okay. Right, thanks very much.
Okay.